Well, welcome everybody to this Parliamentary Library lecture. I'm Roxanne Missingham and I'm the Parliamentary Librarian, and I'm absolutely delighted to see you here, and particularly delighted that we have Associate Professor Jeanette Lindsay with us. It's the topic of climate change and all of the related issues. Probably there hasn't been anything that has seen the depth of analysis and discussion in many years in the Parliament. So we're very fortunate to have today someone who is an internationally acknowledged expert, not just a nationally acknowledged expert. Dr. Lindsay is the Associate Professor of Climatology and Deputy Director of the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University. She is Deputy Director of the ANU Climate Change Institute and has had a stellar career working in academic and research institutions in Australia, the UK and South Africa. Her research interests centre on the nature of climate variability and change and its impact, particularly on drought and bushfires, seasonal climate forecasting and climate change adaption. She teaches undergraduate and postgraduate courses in climate science and policy at the Australian National University and actively engages in professional and public education communicating climate change science to the community. So she will be at Copenhagen shortly. We were very lucky to get her. And thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Good to you.
Good afternoon, everybody, and I'm particularly delighted that anybody is here, given the competition that is going on in other parts of the location. I saw the wrestling man arriving. I actually know nothing about wrestling. I'm completely ignorant, so I didn't know who he was, but he looked very impressive. Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. I can't think of a more timely opportunity to talk about climate change science, and so I'm delighted to have this opportunity. I have given a title to my talk which is a little different to the one that was advertised to you, but what I am going to talk about is the science of climate change, our current understanding, the latest science that is just coming out in the lead up to the negotiations in Copenhagen that start in 3 weeks' time, 7th of December. I will be there. I'm taking a class of 28 students to study the process, the science and the policy process in situ. And that's a very exciting opportunity that I'm greatly looking forward to, and I'm sure to learn a lot from it. But for today, what I'm going to do is tell you about the science of climate change. Now, please ask questions if you wish as I go. I'm very happy to take questions. And I'll also hope to leave some time at the end to take any discussion. Really, what this is all about is the relationship between our planet and the energy that drives the processes that occur in our atmosphere and in the biosphere, the plants and the animals and so forth. So what I'm talking about is the relationship between Earth and the Sun, and the radiant energy that is put out by the Sun reaches our planetary system and then is caught up in a range of different processes which result in the climate and all of the biological life that we have. And I think this image captures that quite beautifully. As I've mentioned, all the energy that drives the processes within our system comes from the Sun, and that incident solar radiation comes in as shortwave radiation at an approximate energy loading of 340 watts per square meter of surface area at the top of the atmosphere. So if you think of the globe in space, we have all this energy streaming through space to us and arriving at a rate of about 340 watts per square meter. Think of your light bulb. You're talking about usually a 60-watt globe in your light fitting. So we have 340 watts beaming in on us. About 100 watts are just reflected away by the atmosphere, the clouds, the dust and particles in the atmosphere and so on. So we end up with about 240 watts per square meter on average that is absorbed into the system and reaches the surface. Energy that reaches the surface and is absorbed, always absorbed in the atmosphere, is transformed from shortwave, very high energy radiation, which is the solar radiation, to longer wavelength radiation, which we call infrared radiation, and that is what we measure as heat. That is what we actually pick up as warmth in our atmosphere and at the Earth's surface. Now, for the planetary system to be in an energy balance, if we're absorbing 240 watts per square meter, the planet has to emit 240 watts per square meter in total in order for the planetary system to remain balanced. What is happening at the moment is that that balance has been upset, so that more energy is being absorbed than is being emitted. And that's the critical thing that we're here to talk about. That is the fundamental issue behind the climate change science. Why is it that there is more energy currently being retained within the system than is being emitted and that needs to be emitted for the system to be in balance? So the rest of what I talk about is really going to be information around that fact. Before I launch into the climate change issues and the science, I thought I'd just bring to your attention and remind you of a couple of things that might just help to highlight some of the difficulties that a lot of people have engaging with climate change as opposed to climate variability. The bushfires in 2009, which everybody is very much aware of, we have a Royal Commission still going on in Victoria. It was an absolutely tragic event. Not the first time that we've had severe and serious bushfires in Australia, and it won't be the last time. Temperatures in the week ending the 10th of February in that top map there were up over 45 degrees in large parts of southern and central Australia for that week on average, and the maximum temperatures for that week as an anomaly from the normal for that time of the year in February were up 6 degrees above average in parts of southeastern Australia. It was a very hot period, and it came at the end, in the middle of a prolonged drought as well. So we had very dry conditions, extremely hot conditions, and that of course combined with ignition led to the devastating bushfires that we're all so familiar with. At the same time, and this is the thing that's interesting to me as a climate scientist, at the same time there was severe flooding going on in northern Queensland. And people may remember that as well. So the bushfires, I think, received a great deal more attention for obvious reasons. But there was also a great deal of rain falling along the coast of Cape York. That pinky purple colour shows 800 millimetres of rainfall for the month of February this year along the coast. And that was over 400% of the normal February rainfall for that part of the world. So it's a wet area, but this was particularly wet. Not very unusual in Australia to have extremes of climate and to have drought and bushfires and floods and so on, but to have these things occurring simultaneously is not such a usual event. Does this indicate climate change? Is it a signal of climate change? Individual events are not. Individual events cannot be ascribed to climate change. What is of interest in climate change terms is the trend. It's the growing incidence of these events. The frequency of them is increasing, the number is increasing, and their severity is increasing. And it's those trends towards increasing frequency and severity of extreme events that are a characteristic of climate change. Then an example just from a little elsewhere. People may be aware of the very severe typhoon season that is coming to an end now in the Southeast Asian region. This was Typhoon Morakot that affected Taiwan. There's also been severe flooding, landslides, and many deaths in the Philippines and other areas associated with the current tropical storm season. Now there again, a single event like Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Ivan or these typhoons that have just occurred or the one that affected Myanmar last year doesn't necessarily prove climate change. But what we are seeing is an increasing frequency of intense and severe, highest category severity storms. Not necessarily more of them overall, but more of the severe ones. And that is exactly what you expect with climate change in a warmer environment where there is more energy and there is more moisture to drive those storms. So what do the climate observations tell us? Climate observations are collected around the world and have been for a long time. In the Northern Hemisphere, going right back to the 17th century, they've been collecting temperature and rainfall observations. In the Southern Hemisphere, we have consistent observations over the continental areas since about the late 1800s, so about 1880 or so. And since the satellite era, of course, beginning in the 1970s, we have global coverage of observations of temperature and other parameters that allow us to assess rainfall as well. If we look at some of that temperature data, a map like this, which comes from NASA in the United States, shows the temperature anomalies for last year relative to the period from 1961 to 1990. A lot of what I'm going to talk about is relative to that period. 61 to 90 is a 30-year period. It's the World Meteorological Organization-defined climate average period that we're currently using, against which to benchmark all of our individual years and seasons and what's happening with them. Why 30 years? Because in a 30-year period, you'll have some El Nino events, some La Nina events, some bad typhoon years, some years, droughts, floods. You'll get the full range in a 30-year period of events that occur. If you took 10 years, you might get the 10 years that we had in the 1990s when we had six El Nino years. And that would bias the observations and the average that you would get. So that 30-year period, and we're looking at January to December 2008 as an anomaly. The global temperature anomaly was just short of 0.4 of 1 degree relative to that earlier period. We can see the temperatures are between 2 and 3 degrees above average in the red in the high latitudes of the northern hemisphere, and above average over most continental areas, particularly in the northern hemisphere, not so much over North America, where the temperatures were either average or slightly below. And we can also see, which I'll just point out, here in the Pacific, an extended area of cooler temperatures below the average, which was associated with the La Nina event that occurred in the Pacific last year. We've had two La Nina events in a row, 2007 and 2008. We are now 2009-10 in an El Nino event. El Nino involves warming in the Pacific, La Nina involves cooling. These events give a signature to the global temperature anomaly, which is quite discernible. So that the anomaly in 2008 was lower by as much as 0.2 of a degree because of the large cooling that occurred over the Pacific in that year. With El Nino, we expect to see a similar increase in the temperature for 2009-2010. One can reconstruct maps like that going back in time, and what one sees if one starts in about 1950 and comes through to the present is that the maps get increasingly red. They vary from year to year, there's a lot of variability in the system, but they just become more and more orange and red as you come towards the present, which is an indication of the warming that has been occurring. This is a version of a graph that shows a reconstruction of temperatures, particularly in the northern hemisphere, that's 1,000 years long. It goes back 1,000 years before the present, and it uses a range of proxy methods for assessing what the temperature has been in the past. And the fact that there are a range of different proxies gives you a fairly wide spread between these different coloured lines. So some of these are based on tree ring analysis, some are based on the analysis of pollens from bogs and lakes. That sort of thing has been used to reconstruct the temperatures back that far. The black line shows the observational temperatures since we have reliable thermometer-based observations in the Northern Hemisphere. And what we see is that back about 1,000 years ago, there was a relatively warm period called the medieval warm period, and this is very well documented in the northern hemisphere particularly, and the temperatures then cooled to the little ice age, which was a cooler period between about 1550 and about 1750. So, and this period is very well documented in art and literature from Europe. There's many paintings and a lot of reference in literature to cold conditions that are just not experienced any longer in those areas. Then we see temperatures increasing after the Little Ice Age, going into the early part of the 19th century, and then taking off from about the middle of the 19th century until we hit the high temperatures that we are currently experiencing in the 2000s. And it's very clear.
Are you saying that the temperatures now are warmer than the medieval warm
yes,
period?
Yes, I am saying that the temperatures now are warmer than the medieval warm period. There is no doubt that that is the case. We can also put this into a much longer time frame. This is the famous Vostok ice core record that people may have heard about. And so what we're looking at here is 450,000 years of reconstruction of the atmospheric carbon dioxide. And there's also a temperature reconstruction which mirrors this very closely, showing the warm interglacial periods and the cool glacial periods over that period of time. And in fact, more recent work has extended that record back 1 million years. So we actually have 1 million-year record of glacial-interglacial cycles, which, and the same thing's been done in Greenland, so it's global, that shows warm periods, gradual decline in cooler temperatures, and then quite abrupt changes back towards warmer conditions. What this also shows is that the range of carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere through all of this time, going back 1 million years and more, has been between 180 and 280 parts per million of CO2. The carbon dioxide analysis is done by extracting the gases from air bubbles trapped in the ice, and it's possible then to make this reconstruction. The current levels of carbon dioxide are indicated by the red line. We are currently on 385 to 390 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. That is unprecedented in the last 2 million years. Coming back closer to the present again, if we look at the record of global air temperatures, and look in more detail now at what's been happening towards the more recent end of that multicoloured last thousand year graph that I showed you, we can see some interesting things that are worth investigating further. There's 1961 to 1990, so that's the averaging period, and that defines where the horizontal line is on the graph. If you change the averaging period, for example, if we shifted it this way, that line would drop down. The overall shape of the black line wouldn't change, but the line would just drop down. If we shifted this way, the line moves up a little bit. So it's just an orientation thing. So what do we see? From 1850, temperatures fluctuating, but pretty much about between 0.2 and 0.4 degrees below the recent average, and then an increase in the early part of the 20th century, which leveled out and then took off again in about the middle 1970s. So what's been going on? It's really interesting to evaluate what is behind this rise here, the slowdown, and then the further rise in the more recent times, and that's what I will now concentrate on. Bearing in mind that overall we have seen in the 20th and early part of the 21st century about 0.8 of a degree of overall warming. Okay, and this amount of warming has occurred because of natural factors and human activities. There is a combination of the two at work, and that is what is illustrated partly in this slide. The factors that are associated with changes in temperature are numerous. They include changes in solar output. The output of energy from the sun changes over time. It's called solar irradiance, and I'll say a bit more about that in just a second. So there's variations, differences in the amount of sunlight that arrives at the Earth. Once it arrives, it encounters the atmosphere, and what is in the atmosphere plays a crucial role. Aerosols, or tiny particles in the atmosphere, are particularly important, and there are a range of these. There's dust, for example, that's kicked up by dust storms and from volcanic eruptions. There is soot. There is the sulfate aerosol, which is an industrial emission very largely. Now, some of these have a cooling effect because they reflect incoming shortwave radiation, solar radiation, rather than absorbing it or allowing it to pass through, and it therefore doesn't participate in any further processes within the system. Some, however, like soot, absorb radiation within the atmosphere and release it as heat, and therefore contribute to warming in the atmosphere. So there's a role there. Volcanoes are also putting out these things, and of course that is entirely a natural phenomenon which occurs from time to time and which is unpredictable. If we come back to just considering the solar output variability for a second, that's quite an interesting story. The blue here is the reconstructed solar irradiance, and the orange is the temperature record of this period, observed with thermometers around the world. So we see that the two are very closely paralleling each other until we get to the late 1970s. So the period when temperatures were somewhat lower, solar irradiance was somewhat lower in the late 19th century. Early 20th century, solar irradiance picked up, and so did temperatures, and then both leveled off through this middle part of the 20th century. However, the solar irradiance hasn't hardly changed in the recent couple of decades, the last 20 to 30 years, whereas temperatures have changed markedly through that time. There is no way that one can account for the temperatures that we have observed occurring through from about 1980 using solar irradiance as the primary driver. It just doesn't do it because it has not increased over that time. So if we think about the temperature graph, we have definitely a solar irradiance variation playing a role, which is a significant one, and that's important. There is also actually a signal in here of increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, but it's minor compared to the solar output variation. Here we have a double role. The solar irradiance drops off, but also there's an increase in industrial pollution, which is associated with the Second World War. The massive industrial expansion that took place to service the war effort in Europe and in America and in Asia too really involved a great deal of dirty smokestack industry, and that put a lot of soot and dust and sulfate aerosol into the atmosphere, which partly accounted for what's called a dust veil effect or global dimming, and therefore dropped the temperatures through that period. Once we hit the 1960s and 70s with the environmental awareness of things like acid rain and so on, there was a big move to clean up that pollution, nothing to do with global warming in terms of the concern, but that cleanup, of course, has resulted in a reduction in the global dimming effect but the irradiance has not picked up despite the fact that the temperatures have risen. So there is a natural variation here, but that's not the whole story. The other thing that has been changing, of course, as we know, is the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Here we have carbon dioxide, methane and nitrous oxide over the last 2,000 years, and one can see that all of them have fluctuated, but have kept within pretty narrow bounds over that period of time. And then once the Industrial Revolution and large-scale intensive agriculture kick in, the levels of these gases in the atmosphere increase quite dramatically. The current level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, as I mentioned, is around 390 parts per million. The figure for 2009 is still being assessed. The figure for 2008 is 385 parts per million, and it's growing at approximately 3% per year. It's been growing at actually 3.6% per year over the last 9 years or so. It's slowed down currently because of the global financial crisis and the reduction in economic activity. So we would expect this year to actually be a somewhat lesser rise than we've been experiencing in recent years. And that may continue for another year, but then we would expect that things will pick up again as economic activity picks up. So the attribution question has been an absolutely critical one, obviously, and a great deal of the debate around climate change science has focused on issues of uncertainty and attribution. How do we know that there is a human signal in what we observe occurring? There is no doubt that global warming is occurring. We have all the evidence to show it. There is no doubt that the temperatures that we have now are higher than anything that we've seen in the recent past, and that the CO2 levels are higher than they have been in the recent past. But can we look through the human agency? Can we actually attribute it? And when one is considering attribution, there are two things that an explanation has to comply with. First of all, that the observed changes that one is seeing are required to be consistent with the expected responses to the forcings that we know are in the system in order for us to be able to understand them and explain them. So our explanations must be able to do that. And there has to be no alternative explanation, no understandable alternative explanation, given our understanding at this time. Now, I would consider myself to be a skeptic in the true scientific sense, in that I question everything that is put in front of me. And that is what science is about. Science is about taking observations, taking other people's ideas and their explanations for what they see, and questioning them and testing them and trying to find different ways of understanding the world. The attribution question has been dealt with in many different ways, but this, I think, is a really interesting one to look at. The black line on both of these graphs is the same, and it shows the observed temperatures of the 20th century, global temperatures averaged. In the top, what we see is the outcome of a range of models, global climate models that have been run, and the sort of lighter orange is lots of very thin lines that show different runs of different models that have been used to simulate the climate of the 20th century, starting at the beginning in 1900 and then letting the models do the simulation. Included in the modelling is the large-scale volcanic eruptions that have occurred through the 20th century. In the top, also included are solar output variability and the greenhouse gases and the industrial pollution. All of those things are in there. And it is, I think, quite remarkable to note how closely that modelling has been able to mirror the observed temperatures of the 20th century. If we look at the bottom graph in the blue, in this case, the modelling did not include the greenhouse gases. It did not include the industrial emissions and the anthropogenic greenhouse gases to do with land use change and industry. It put in all the natural forcings, the solar output changes and the volcanic eruptions, but it did not include the human agency. It is not possible to reproduce the temperature behaviour that we have observed in the 20th century using the most sophisticated modelling that we have without including the anthropogenic changes that have been occurring due to our activities. We don't have an alternative explanation at this point. There is no other explanation than that we have a combination here of natural variation and human activity, with human activity dominating in the most recent two or three decades. Just bringing things a little bit closer to home, temperature observations at Canberra. Canberra annual mean daily maximum temperatures from 1971 to 2007, a very clear increasing trend with a lot of fluctuations and variability as you would expect. 2008 was slightly warmer again, and we would expect that 2009 is going to be up there as well. In addition to changes in air temperature close to the surface, we're also seeing changes in the ocean temperatures. And this is really important because the ocean has a large capacity to absorb heat. It has a large thermal mass and a very high heat capacity. And what we're seeing is that overall, and in the top map, the trend in sea surface temperatures around the Australian region in degrees per decade from 1970 to 2008 shows warming along the New South Wales coast, for example, there of about 0.2 of a degree per decade. And we're looking at almost four decades there. So about 0.8 of a degree of warming in the ocean along the New South Wales coast, and somewhat less up around Cape York, for example, but more off WA. In winter, we've seen the greatest warming, where there's more than 1 degree of overall warming in the trend over that period of time. Now, this is important because we've got, a pool of warmer water sitting right on the coast, lots of energy, it's evaporating into the atmosphere, giving energy there, and any weather systems that come through are going to pick up on that energy and could become more intense and more severe. Think about the flooding that we've been having along the coast. We haven't been getting the rain inland, unfortunately, but we've been getting flooding rains along the coast with increasing frequency over the last couple of decades here in Australia. And part of the reason for this is the ocean warming and the extra energy that is available for those storms. And there's no reason to suggest that that won't continue to increase into the future. And it poses a lot of challenges for coastal infrastructure and emergency management and so on. Coming back to Canberra, just looking at indicators of high temperature. We're currently in the middle of a particularly warm period. There are different ways of defining heat waves. The Bureau of Meteorology uses various levels, so 35 degrees is often one, or 36.5 degrees. And looking at the number of days during heat waves with those kinds of temperatures in Canberra and dividing the time period of our record between 1939 to 72 and 73 to 2006, the figures speak for themselves. All of these different measures of heat waves, number of heat wave events, the duration of them, the total number of days above certain temperatures, all of that sort of thing, shows that there has been a substantial and highly statistically significant increase in all of these measures of very hot conditions in the Canberra region, and this is repeated around Australia. Now, why would we care about this? Well, if it's hot and it's dry, or even tending to be an average rainfall year, there'll be more evaporation and you'll have less soil moisture, less runoff, agriculture is stressed and challenged. Temperatures in the higher end of this range, up to 36.5 degrees, have physiological effects on human beings, particularly the very young and the elderly and people who are unwell. So there are many, many consequences of an increasing tendency towards hotter conditions that we have to be aware of. What do we do when it gets hotter? We turn on the air conditioner. Have you noticed how many more houses have air conditioners on the outsides of them that are being switched on more and more? It's very cheap to buy an air conditioner, and they're being pushed at us by the advertisers all the time. What is that doing? It's using more power, more electricity. The peak demand in Australia for power, what caused problems in Victoria last summer, was air conditioning. That's when the peak demand occurs, when people switch on their air conditioners. So that kind of load, that demand for power, the use of fossil fuels to generate that power, there's a circle going on there, which is very well worth keeping an eye on and being aware of. If we think about rainfall, I've mentioned rainfall, if we think about rainfall a bit more, the trends in rainfall in Australia are very interesting indeed. And there's a bit of a cautionary tale in here, I think. If we look at the trend in millimetres per decade in rainfall for Australia over the entire period from 1900 to 2008, there really isn't much of a trend. Very slightly drier in the southwest and up in Queensland, and a bit wetter, actually, over much of the rest of the country. So if one looks at that, one could say, well, really, we haven't got a problem. It's all okay, it's fine. But the time period over which one looks at any of these records is important. I've shown you the long temperature records. Now let's have a look at what the effect of looking at a long rainfall record is. It was very dry in the Federation time, around the turn of the century. So if one looks at it, an overall trend from 1900 to the present, one sees very little trend because you're going from dry condition to dry condition with a wetter period in the middle. If we start in 1950, which was actually somewhat wetter, it's around the wettest period in that 100-year record that we have, we see something quite different. Starting in 1950, the trend shows that it's getting wetter in the northwest between 1950 and 2008, substantially drier in the southwest, and drier in the east. And if we start in 1970, the picture is even more severe. What this illustrates is that it's very important to be mindful of the time period that one is looking at when observing these climate records and trying to make conclusions about what is going on. It also shows that there is an intensifying trend both to getting wetter in the northwest and to drying in the eastern half of Australia. And there is no sign that that trend is diminishing at this point. Is it climate change? Well, there's been a great deal of work going on, and as this work continues at universities like the ANU, at CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology, looking at the evidence for climate change signals in these trends. And this is where we've got to at the present time. There is strong evidence of a climate change signal in the southwest Western Australian rainfall decrease. That rainfall decrease occurred as a step change in 1976. Rainfall suddenly dropped by about 20%, and it has remained at those lower levels since then. There is some suggestion that it may have actually dropped again slightly. There is strong evidence of a climate change signal involving the high pressure belt of the southern hemisphere, the ridge of high pressure that extends across the Indian Ocean, across Australia and over to the Pacific. The drying trend in the south, in Victoria, southern New South Wales, into South Australia and Tasmania, there is this year work that has just been published that indicates a climate change signal there as well, also associated with the changes in the high pressure belt. What is going on in Queensland and northern New South Wales, though, at this stage, is not so clearly attributable. So at this stage, we don't know. It has not been possible to find a climate change-related mechanism for that, which is not to suggest that there isn't one, but we cannot say at this point that that is definitely due to climate change. So there are mixed signals there on the temperature. Taking evidence like this, this kind of broad-scale analysis that I talked about first, and then the detailed analysis that I've just shown you very briefly for parts of Australia, taking that kind of information from around the world, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, in the fourth assessment report published in the first half of 2007, made statements like the following, and I've highlighted particular words. Very high confidence that the globally averaged net effect of human activities is warming. It's unequivocal that there is warming. It's very likely that anthropogenic greenhouse gas increases caused most of the observed increase in temperature. Now, I've highlighted those words quite specifically because the IPCC works on a consensus process. The scientists who work on putting together the synthesis of published work have to agree on the wording, which then goes through a political process to approve the final wording of the synthesis that is put out as a statement, the summary for policymakers. And so one doesn't find extreme statements in the IPCC report. It's just in the nature of the process that's used to produce it. Also, the sort of language that is used is very specific. It's quite precise. So very high confidence is code for 95% certain. Unequivocal means 99.9% certain. So in effect, there is actually a probability that is being assigned to these statements, although they're not being expressed mathematically. And that's the first time, the 2007 report is the first time that the IPCC actually did that. Prior to that, the language was much more imprecise and moderate and didn't have this indication of probability. So through the life of the IPCC, we've seen increasing certainty as more and more information has come in and our understanding has improved. So what about faster change and more serious risks? What I'd like to focus on now very briefly is the sort of evidence that we have for rapidity of change, and particularly evidence that has come in since the IPCC published that report. And I think it's worth highlighting this because IPCC came out in 2007. It appeared in April. The cutoff for taking in new data and new information was a year before that. It can take up to 2 years, even 3 years, for scientific work to be published in the literature after it's completed. That means that the work that was in the IPCC report and reflected in that report could have been between 4 and 5 years old by the time it made it into the report, because they only use peer-reviewed scientific literature. Since then, there has been an enormous amount of research coming out in every type of science associated with climate change. So what do we see? The Arctic is showing very profound signs of climate change. There is no doubt that there are responses to the global warming that we are experiencing occurring in the Arctic in a very significant way. just having a look at the graph, the blue in that graph on the left shows modelling that was done about 10 years ago or so to show the rate of decline of the Arctic summer sea ice through to 2050 on assumed rates of warming between that time and the middle of the century. The red line shows what's actually been observed in terms of Arctic summer sea ice extent. And if you watch the graph, you'll see where 2007 was on that graph, way outside the range of all of the uncertainties in the modelling. The map shows the extent of the Arctic summer sea ice in 2007, and it's quite clearly very much reduced relative to the yellow line, which is the average for the latter part of the 20th century, and even 2005, which is in the green line that you can see there. So this is the concentration of ice in the Arctic. 2008 was very slightly more than 2007. What has happened this year? The Arctic summer sea ice minimum is reached in September, in the middle of September. And there's a very useful website that one can go to have a look at all of this information that's collected. And one can see here in this graph the 2009 summer sea ice extent in the pale blue relative to 2008 in the darker blue, 2005 in the green, and 2007 in this dotted green line. So 2007 for the moment remains the minimum. One cannot call what has occurred in 2009 a recovery at this stage. The average for the latter part of the 20th century is up there in the grey. The other thing that's occurring in the Arctic is not only that there is a decrease in the amount of the Arctic Ocean, the area that is covered by ice in the summer, but also there is a thinning of the ice, which makes it more vulnerable to warming and melting the following year. And that is shown by the age of the ice. You may not be able to see this very clearly, but ice that is only 1 year old or is 2 years old is thinner than the ice that is older. And here in the purple, we see the one-year-old ice, 2008-2009. Looking at the top there, 1981 to 2000, most of the ice covering the Arctic Ocean was actually more than 2 years old. In 2008, most of the ice was only 1 year old. In 2009, there was a bit more second-year ice, but also a substantial amount of two-year-old ice, as well as substantial areas, extensive areas, with no ice at all. There is a positive feedback effect that occurs when one reduces the ice cover in an area like this. Ice has and snow has a light colour. It reflects incoming sunlight and therefore remains relatively cool, whereas the exposed ocean has a darker colour and absorbs more energy and warms. So it's called albedo, the reflectivity. So that the ice albedo effect is a positive feedback. The more you melt the ice, the greater the warming that occurs because there's more absorption of energy in the exposed darker ocean surface, and so you go. So the story in the Arctic is such that scientists who 5 or 10 years ago were saying, well, we might be seeing an ice-free Arctic Ocean in the summertime by perhaps 2070, are now suggesting that we could be seeing an ice-free Arctic Ocean in the summertime by 2030 or even earlier. And the reason that we know that this is really true is that there are shipbuilding companies in Europe and in North America that are building ships to navigate the Northwest Passage, which they are assuming within the next 3 years is going to be ice-free in the summer and give them a quicker commercial route through between Europe and
may not know it, there's been two commercial vessels that have done the Northeast Passage without icebreaker assistance this year.
Really? I didn't know that. Yeah.
So has it ever happened before?
Not in the term of any of our records, no. Absolutely not. So that tells a story in and of itself. I'm going to talk briefly about Greenland now. Now, the reason that we know that the ice in Greenland is melting is because we can observe it. And the reason we expect it to continue is that Rio Tinto and those companies, Anglo-American and so on, are buying up the mineral rights to what is currently under the ice. So there again, they are banking on the fact that there is an expectation that the ice is going to go. So, of course, what is occurring with Greenland is that the ice is melting, but it's melting around the fringes of the ice cap at the moment. And it's actually still accumulating in the middle, which is an interesting thing. The point about the Greenland ice, which makes it so important, is that there's an awful lot of it. 3 million cubic kilometres, which is a number I can't even imagine. It's just enormous. 1,600 metres thick, etc., etc. If all the ice on Greenland melts, we'll get 7 metres of global sea level rise on average. Now, it's going to take a long time. It'll take about 200 to 300 years to melt all of that ice, get the sort of current projections for global warming. But sea level rise will continue and grow as that ice progressively melts. Melting the Arctic sea ice doesn't actually raise sea level because the ice is floating and it's displacing its own volume, but melting the Greenland ice cap certainly does because it's sitting on the land at the present time. And you put that water in the ocean, it's like pouring water into the glass and eventually it overflows. So 7 meters of sea level rise from that. And of course, if we get large-scale melting of land grounded ice around Antarctica, then that will add to sea level rise as well. And you can see some facts there about the increased rate of melting. And there are processes occurring which, again, once one knows them and understands them, seem very straightforward and simple, but were not necessarily foreseen. So there's a lot of meltwater that accumulates on the surface of the glaciers. That, again, absorbs more energy and warms the temperatures. And that water goes down the crevasses in the ice to the interface between the ice and the surface at the rock and lubricates that. So what is happening now in Greenland is that wherever there are valley glaciers feeding out from the central ice mass, they're accelerating, they're moving much more rapidly down their valleys and out to sea. And you know, those icebergs are calving and they're melting. So there's an acceleration process occurring there which hadn't been anticipated when all the early understandings and modelling was being done. So I've mentioned sea level rise. The ocean is changing. I talked about the rising ocean temperatures around Australia. There are rising temperatures around the global ocean. The heat content is shown in the top graph, and we can see increases from 1960 through to the present of the heat content of the ocean in the upper 700 meters. So that's, of course, the layer that is most directly affected by atmospheric temperature and solar radiation. And these are global mean sea level values. From two different sources, from tide gauges, which are situated around the coasts and are directly measuring the sea level, and from satellite altimeters, which measure from using satellite technology what the height of the sea level is. And we can see the rising sea level. Now, a large part of the sea level rise that we've seen so far has occurred due to thermal expansion. The ocean is warming and therefore it's expanding. However, that is now changing. So from 1961 to 2003, the average rate of sea level rise was about 1.6 millimetres a year, which seems very little. About 40% of it was thermal expansion, 35% from glacier and ice cap melting, and 25% from continental ice sheets. Work that was published just last year showed that the rate of sea level rise is growing 2.5 millimetres per year most recently, and the thermal expansion component has dropped dramatically to only 20%. Whereas the contribution from melting glaciers and ice caps and continental ice sheets is now greater and a bigger proportion of that. And we would expect that that would continue as the melting of the land-based ice masses progresses. And of course, there are many other factors associated with that and impacts of that, which one might not necessarily think about. Mountain glaciers are the main source of fresh water for many hundreds of millions of people around the world. Think about people in Nepal and India and Pakistan and in South America, for instance. Once those glaciers are gone, there is no fresh water for those communities. While the glaciers are melting, they're facing increasing problems with what are called glacial lake outburst floods, or GLOFs, where there are natural lakes, natural dams that are formed from rock rubble from within the valleys from the glaciers in the past. These trap the meltwater. And because the rate of meltwater formation is increasing, the dams are not able to cope with the excess water, and so they break, and the communities that are living downstream are then flooded out. Another dimension to the issues about mountain glaciers is an international one. In many cases, the mountain with its glacier, that is the headwater of the river, is in one country, and the use of that water is in a neighbouring country. So there are many transboundary issues just simmering there at the moment, and I can only see that these are going to get worse. I think that conflict over water, with rainfall change and variability and the problems of fresh water currently sourced from ice melt, are going to be very large as we move into the future. But coming back to sea level rise, the IPCC report in 2007 suggested that sea level rise by 2100 would be of the order of about 30 centimetres or so, 30 to 40 or so centimetres. This was one area of the report where the scientists literally could not agree, and so they took the lowest common denominator approach and just projected from the historical rate of rise that had been observed up to just after 2000 through at a rate of 3.2 millimetres per year. However, Stefan Rahmstorf, who is currently the lead scientist in the world working on sea level rise at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Change in Germany, has done more recent work with a great deal of observation and modelling, and what he has come up with for different IPCC scenarios of future climate change emissions, a range of global sea level rise by 2100 between 75 and 190 centimetres. At the moment, as I'm about to show you, our carbon dioxide emissions are tracking along the A1FI, the fossil fuel intensive mode, the more orange one right up there at the top, or higher, which would suggest that if we continue along that path, we could have 2 metres of global sea level rise by the end of the century. And by the middle of the century, which is a time that some of us may still be around to see, we could be looking at about 0.5 metre or so on that graph. So think about the current situation. Tuvalu and Kiribati are already losing islands. They've already had to relocate people. By 2030, they're not going to be habitable anymore. Kiribati certainly won't be, and the entire population is going to have to leave and go somewhere else. Lots of issues associated with that. That's based on current projections. If we're looking at this kind of sea level rise, we're talking about of the order of 40 to 50 major cities with tens of millions of inhabitants in coastal areas around the world, many of them in the Southeast Asian region, which are going to be in big trouble from sea level rise. I was recently in Vietnam at a conference, and they were talking about the Mekong and the Yellow Rivers and the impact that this is going to have on Ho Chi Minh City, for example, and they are very deeply concerned. They're putting in infrastructure to try to deal with it, but in the end, they were saying the infrastructure is only going to be able to go so far and we'll be looking at relocation. We'll just have to move. There's no going to be no choice. Of course, it's not only people and living, it's also agricultural production. River Delta locations around the world are amongst the most fertile food production areas that there are. So I mentioned where we are tracking with our fossil fuel emissions. This is a graph that I got from Michael Raupach, who is a co-author on a paper that is about to appear in Nature, and also co-author of a recent report of the Global Carbon Project, which was just released a couple of days ago, reporting on data up to the end of last year. And what it shows is the observations of our fossil fuel emissions in gigatons of carbon per year, and those are the dots that one can see there, 2006, 7 and 8, added on to what the International Energy Agency has in the little black squares, and the coloured lines are the various IPCC scenarios of future emissions, projected from 2000. The red there is the A1FI scenario, which is the fossil fuel intensive scenario, basically kind of along the lines of business as usual. We continue global economic expansion, population continues to grow at current rates, and we maintain our reliance on fossil fuels as a primary source of energy. And what's clear from that is that at least to the end of 2008, our emissions have been tracking very much along the A1FI scenario line, or in fact slightly higher than that line. In this respect, the global financial crisis has done the world a favour, because the slowdown in economic activity has slowed the rate of emissions. Total human-induced CO2 emissions, this is looking just from 1960, very largely from fossil fuel, 3.5% per year growth, which I mentioned earlier on in the talk, from 2000 to 2008. So you can see that, in fact, it had accelerated over that period. If you take a line through that, say, from about 1980 to about 2000, and then look at 2000 to 2008, you can see the acceleration of emissions from fossil fuels. 2% growth in 2008, so a slowdown. The expectation is that we will be looking at probably around 1% growth for 2009, possibly into 2010, between 1% and 2%, and then the expectation is that it will pick up and continue along the sort of trend that we had before. And bear in mind that economic growth rates in countries like India and China have not reacted to the global financial crisis in the way that was anticipated at all. They have continued powering along at a much more rapid rate than had been thought would be the case under the current circumstances. Apart from fossil fuel emissions, the other major source of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere is actually deforestation. And in this there is a good news story, perhaps, we hope, we think. You can see deforestation emissions tracking along and then a decline in the last couple of years. About 15% of total emissions from 2000 to 2008 came from deforestation, but there is that indication of a drop-off in those emissions, signs of a decreasing trend. Now, if that was to continue, that would be very good news, both from a point of view of climate change and the atmospheric environment and global warming, but also from the point of view of forest ecosystems and biodiversity preservation and so on. Okay. Now, there's another... So that was some good news, because I didn't want to give you entirely bad news, but there is another bit of news which is not so good, and that is that the carbon emissions that have been going into the atmosphere, largely from fossil fuel use and also from things like deforestation, have been offset to a large extent in terms of their impact on global warming by the capacity of the Earth system to absorb some of this carbon. The ocean takes up carbon, and the biosphere, the growing plants, take up carbon as well. So in the top there, we see the CO2 emissions, just the same as we had in the previous graph. And in the bottom, we see the atmospheric CO2 growth. So how much CO2 is actually in the atmosphere and the change of that from year to year. And that is not quite tracking parallel to the CO2 emissions. And the reason for that is that there is absorption within the system. So the air takes about 45% of the emissions from industry and from deforestation. Land-based vegetation takes up about 29% of what's been put into the atmosphere, and the ocean takes up about 26%. These are the sinks for CO2. They're absorbing it. However, their capacity to absorb is decreasing, and that's the bad news, unfortunately. As the ocean and as the land biosphere is responding to global warming, to the temperature and rainfall changes that are occurring, and to the increasing habitat loss and fragmentation and so forth, it's changing. It's changing their capacity to take up CO2 that we're putting into the atmosphere. And so the airborne fraction of CO2 has been increasing slightly over this time, with large changes, as you can see. So on the short term, if one just looks over a period of, say, 10 years, there's a great deal of variability, and this is a response to climate variability. If we look at this over the longer term, there is this trend which shows that there is 5% more carbon dioxide in the airborne fraction over this period from 1960 to the present than there was at the beginning of that period, because of the fact that the sinks are starting to show signs of becoming saturated. It's called sink saturation, where they're no longer able to absorb. And if that continues, then that's a problem, because we will have more greenhouse gas in the atmosphere where it participates in global warming, and rates of temperature increase will accelerate. So what about future climate change? Well, of course we use models to look at projections, and these models have used the IPCC scenarios for emissions in order to generate possible futures in terms of temperature. 2025, a period not too far in the future, and 2095, somewhat more distant and towards the end of the century, looking at a low emission, medium emission and high emission scenario. And I'd remind you that we are currently tracking along the high emission end of things. The reason that I show this set of maps is really to make a particular point, and that is that if we look at 2025, we cannot actually see any difference between those maps. It doesn't matter whether you're thinking that your emissions are going along the low, medium, or high emission scenario for what temperatures are going to do by 2025 and the associated changes in rainfall and everything else, because the CO2, the methane, the nitrous oxide, the other greenhouse gases that are already in the atmosphere, that we have already emitted, are going to produce this kind of pattern of global warming and that amount of global warming. The decisions that are made now, here in this place, in this week, the decisions that are made in Copenhagen in a few weeks' time, will have the potential to have a dramatic effect on which of these scenarios we're going to be living with in the future and our children and our grandchildren will be living with. A world, if we take a less fossil fuel intensive approach, with a lower population growth in the top there, where there is still a relatively high degree of warming of the order of 2.5 degrees over the continental areas, about 4 degrees in the Arctic. You lose the summer sea ice in the Arctic for sure, and in fact probably most of the sea ice in the Arctic in all seasons, but 2 degrees of warming, a possibility by the end of the century. If we continue along the high emissions pathway, we could be looking at 7 to 8 degrees of warming in the Arctic by the end of the century. There will be no ice. All the Greenland ice will melt. Not immediately, it'll take a couple of hundred years to disappear, but it will all go, if we go that far. And Australia is looking at 4 degrees of warming. We've already seen the changes that we have experienced in the world, the impact that we're seeing from 0.8 of a degree. If we get to 4 degrees, it's a world that we just really find difficulty imagining. And so the message that came out of the Climate Change Science Conference in Copenhagen in March that I attended as a precursor to the negotiations at the end of the year made a very clear statement that 2 degrees of warming is something that we really do not think as a scientific community we should be exceeding. That's the boundary. And that was picked up by the Danish Prime Minister very clearly. That equates to about 450 parts per million of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. Now, I say greenhouse gas, not carbon dioxide, because there are the other gases, methane and nitrous oxide and so on, which I haven't really talked about. If we put all the gases together and look at them as equivalent to the warming potential of CO2, we're actually pretty close to 450 already, if not already there. So we are more than likely committed to 2 degrees of warming already. We have a slight chance of avoiding getting there, although I personally don't think we do have a chance of avoiding 2 degrees. We have a chance of avoiding getting much beyond 2 degrees if we move quickly to reduce our emissions. And we have to move quickly. We have to peak emissions within the next decade and then start turning them around. They have to decrease by 3% per year at least after that in order to do anything sensible about a 2-degree maximum for global warming, yes.
What part do you see water vapour playing as the major greenhouse gas?
Water vapour is a really important and interesting factor in all of this. It's not talked about in the sort of graphs that I've shown because it's not directly influenced by human activity. So CO2, methane and nitrous oxide are clearly being emitted by our activities into the atmosphere. Water vapour is there anyway and it fluctuates by an order of magnitude over time. The amount of water vapour in the atmosphere, let me step back one second. The amount of water in the system is finite and closed. The distribution of that water in the different parts of the system changes over time and varies. The amount of water vapour in the atmosphere depends on the temperature of the air relative to the temperature of the surface and the amount of open water surface that's available to evaporate into the atmosphere. Now, because we have a planet that's 73 or 75% ocean, there's no shortage of open evaporating water surface. So there's no limit in terms of having access to water to evaporate into the air. So it's really driven by temperature. As the atmosphere warms, it becomes more humid. And that is, in fact, what we are seeing. Evaporation rates over the oceans are increasing, and we know this. It's very hard to measure, actually. But we know it because the salinity of the ocean, particularly in the tropics, is increasing. That means that there is less fresh water going in and more fresh water being evaporated out and the salts remain behind. So we have that indicator of increased evaporation. Also, in many parts of the world, contrary to what had been thought would be the case, evaporation over land areas is actually decreasing. There had been an assumption that because rising temperatures mean more evaporation, the land areas would just evaporate more and it would get dry. But in fact, evaporation rates in many areas have been decreasing. And that is because the air is moister. It has more moisture in it, on average in general, because it's evaporating off the oceans. And the land areas make up a relatively small proportion of the total surface area of the Earth. So the role of that water vapour then in terms of warming is significant. Water vapour is a greenhouse gas, so it absorbs long-wave radiation and warms the atmosphere. So the more water vapour, in fact, the warmer things get. But if that water vapour turns into clouds and is condensed into cloud droplets, then it can either have a warming or a cooling effect depending on what type of cloud forms at what level in the atmosphere. So this is quite a complex relationship, which is an imperfectly understood. I wouldn't say that the overall principles are well understood, Exactly how it's playing out at the present time is the subject of current research, ongoing research. So water vapor is crucial. Thank you very much for asking that question. And I hope I've helped you to understand a bit about how it's responding. But it's not as simple. There was an idea a little while ago that if you had it got warmer, you had more evaporation, you got more clouds, that reflected away the sunlight, it therefore got cooler again, and you had a very nice feedback loop that would be a thermostat that would govern the system.
So there's no negative feedback.
That actually doesn't work. Unfortunately not. Okay, so there's a whole range of impacts there. Now, I appreciate that I've probably gone over time. May I take a couple of minutes just to go through this? Because it shows some very interesting relationships within the system. It's called teleconnections and feedbacks, and it's called that. Teleconnections just mean relationships at a distance. Now, there are many aspects of this, our Earth system, where something that occurs in one area has an impact somewhere else, and there's no obvious connection unless you understand the science of what's going on. The good example of this is the El Niño, where we have warming that happens in the Pacific Ocean from time to time, which affects rainfall in Africa, for instance, at a vast distance from the Pacific. That's a teleconnection. Now, there are many aspects of the system which are susceptible to impacts from global warming and other aspects of climate change. These are called, in this context, they're called tipping elements. What is indicated in this slide are components of the Earth system function which both are already showing signs of responding to climate change, will respond further if they're pushed further in terms of warming and so on, and also are the sorts of elements that have an impact on other parts of the system. So these are just a few of the many such elements that there are within our system. So let's just think about El Niño. One of the trigger mechanisms for El Niño events actually occurs north of Australia in this area of very warm ocean called the warm pool. And changes there in wind and pressure and so on can trigger El Niño events. With global warming, there is a change in the ocean temperatures here. There's a change in the temperature differential between the ocean here and the Asian continental landmass, which controls pressure gradients and wind systems. And that is having an impact on El Niño events and the El Niño system. When there is an El Niño event, the Indian monsoon tends to be directly affected. It tends to have below average rainfall. So they have had a bad year. This last summer in India, the summer monsoon was not good. They had flooding in some areas, but they had rainfall failure in many others, and that's typical of an El Niño year. So any changes to the whole ENSO system, the El Niño Southern Oscillation system, affects the monsoon directly. The monsoon involves essentially a kind of big vacuum pump that takes air from the surface where it's warm and moist, creates large clouds by putting it up through the atmosphere to about 10 kilometers above the surface, and then the air flows out away from the Indian subcontinental area and into the surrounding areas and descends. Part of that affects the Tibetan plateau area, and it affects the amount of snow that's received in Tibet the following winter after the summer monsoon. That affects the reflectivity of the Tibetan high altitude area, and that affects radiation balance. The outflow of air from the Indian monsoon also goes across to Africa, in fact. And so if you've got a strong monsoon, you tend to get a high pressure sitting over the Sahara because the air that's come out of the top of the monsoon clouds ends up coming down over Africa, and descending air creates a higher pressure. So we have a situation where a strong monsoon means drier conditions in sub-Saharan Africa, and a weak monsoon tends to mean slightly wetter than average conditions in sub-Saharan Africa. In Chad, there is an area called the Bodeli Depression. It's a paleo lake, so it was a lake in ancient times. It has a very deep deposit of very fine sediment there at the surface. And there's a particular sort of formation of hills around the depression that channels the prevailing easterly winds across the surface of the lake in the summertime. When those winds blow strongly, and it's particularly dry in that area, the dust from the Bodeli Depression blows across the Atlantic and into the Amazon Basin. There it acts as a source of nutrients for the Amazon rainforest. Rainforest soils are actually quite infertile. They depend for their productivity on rapid decomposition of vegetable matter from the forest itself and from any input of nutrients from other sources. That Bodeli Depression dust supply provides an essential source of nutrients for the Amazon, and there is evidence from the paleo community, from paleo research, that shows that in times past, over hundreds of thousands of years ago, when the Sahara was wetter, the Amazon contracted, and when the Sahara has been drier, the Amazon has expanded, and it's because of the control on nutrients across the Atlantic, which is absolutely fascinating. And one of the satellite pictures that you can see, you know, nowadays, that actually show this big dust plume coming across. Sometimes when the wind direction is right, it goes across into the Caribbean as well, so it can go either way. So there's a direct link there. El Nino is also linked to the performance of what's called the marine carbon pump. There are two ways that the ocean takes up carbon. One way is to just dissolve CO2 out of the atmosphere and store it in water. Another way is to take the carbon and use it to build the skeletons of the tiny creatures that live in the water, so the diatoms and so on. And that use of carbon, dioxide of carbon, to build those skeletons of the little creatures which then die and their skeletons drop down to the bottom of the ocean and form deposits on the ocean bed is called the marine carbon pump. It's taking carbon and putting it down to the bottom. When the water is warm, the ocean biological productivity reduces, and so the performance of the marine carbon pump is reduced. It's most effective in colder areas. So when there's an El Nino event and the water is warm here, the marine carbon pump is reduced. So there's another link with El Nino. And that, you can then see, means that there are potential links. Should any of these aspects of the system suffer some large-scale change due to a response to climate change, there's the potential to trigger changes in other parts of the system. It's these interlinkages which I think are so crucial. We understand a great deal about individual little bits of our system. There are experts on everything everywhere, but they're not. Each person is not an expert on everything. Individuals are experts on particular things. So we understand in great detail about many of these things. But do we fully understand the interrelationships between them? I would suggest that we don't. We are starting to see that these kinds of connections are critical. And it's entirely possible from the work that was done to produce this that we are getting very close to the potential tipping point for many, at least some, of these elements, particularly the ones which I'm not going to talk about now in the Northern Hemisphere in the Arctic, which also connect all the way through to all of these others. A tipping point is a component in a point that's reached in the system where it can only take so much change, if you like. So imagine you've got a slightly flexible stick and you can move it and bend it and you can do quite a lot with it, and eventually you just go too far and it breaks. That's the tipping point. We can have an amount of global warming. El Nino can change a bit, the Indian monsoon can change a bit, the Bodelli Depression dust supply can change a bit, but there'll come a point beyond which the system is not robust enough to be able to absorb all of that change any longer, and some element is going to tip over. The Arctic summer sea ice will not be there one summer, and then for all the summers after that. What impact is that going to have on the rest of the system? Now, I'm not actually going to talk through this because it just takes too long. There we go. So I think this is my last slide. I think you get the message. So, what do we have to do? What we really have to do is find ways, and this is where the science hits the policy. I feel that the science, I know that the science is completely clear. There is warming, there is a human agency, and the impacts are clear. The potential future impacts are large, and we really do not want to push the system to the point where we find out just how all the elements link together when various tipping points are crossed. We will not have ecosystem services then that will support us and our activities here on the planet. So what do we have to do? We have to find ways to bring those emissions down. We have to decouple our economic growth from fossil fuel emissions. That, I think, is really the only way. So looking at fossil fuel emissions, we are tracking along that high emissions scenario along the red line, or even worse. We have to, if we are going to achieve 2 degrees or less of global warming in the longer term, we have to peak those emissions within the next 10 years and then bring them down quite rapidly so that we stabilise at 450 parts per million by 2100 or even below. The longer we leave it, the bigger that emissions gap becomes because we're tracking along the red line. How do we fill that emissions gap? How do we address it and bring it down? There is no silver bullet. There is no one way to do this. It requires a mix of approaches and the mix that is relevant to a particular country, to a particular region, is going to be different. All of these things have to factor into it, and there are no doubt many more. Energy efficiency, energy savings, looking at population distribution and growth rates, forestation issues, geosequestration, wind, solar, biofuels and nuclear, all the other possibilities for energy generation. All of these have to be part of the mix. They have to be part of our solutions to this problem. I was here yesterday launching the United Nations State of the World Population Report in Australia. And that was talking about the role of people and populations, and particularly women, in developing countries in the issues of climate change and in addressing climate change. And it was very interesting to engage with all of that and to see population actually coming onto the table in a way that it hasn't previously. It's tended to be an issue that, particularly in the scientific community, people have tended to sort of back away from in climate change. You really don't want to sort of go to the population question. But it is an important one that we do have to consider. There are projections that the UN has put forward that climate change, that population growth could peak by 2100 at either 8 billion or 12 billion. That difference of 4 billion people makes the difference at current projected growth rates of CO2 emissions between a world, if we even took a moderate CO2 emission scenario pathway, of probably 3 to 4 degrees of warming and 7 degrees of warming, if all those people continue to develop, all those countries develop. So there are very serious issues to be confronted around all of this. The message that I would leave you with is that, yes, there is uncertainty. Yes, it's right to question and to query what we see put in front of us. The weight of evidence is overwhelming from the scientific community, and that is why the scientists are saying so clearly, as we go to Copenhagen, that we have to get an agreement. We need a global agreement that is going to reduce emissions. We'll see them peaking globally within the next 10 years and then starting to come down. Otherwise, we will be living in a world that is warmer than 2 degrees after 2050, and that is not a world that we would like to see. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was overwhelming.
No, fantastic.
I think we probably should make time for one or two questions. I mean, I know you have questions through, sure. But if someone would like to ask a question while you're here, it would be wonderful to take that opportunity.
Can I ask you, in your final slide, you had a red line for CO2 emissions, and it began to dip towards 2100.
Yeah.
Is that due to resource scarcity?
Yes. Okay. It's due to the fact that we run out of fossil fuels, basically. So we run out of coal and oil. So, do you want me to go back to it and we can all look at it?
Sure.
Previous. Yeah. There we go. Yeah. Yes. Indeed. So in a way, there's an element in here of the system kind of starting to save itself, no matter what we do. But the fact is that if we get up there, the lags that are in the system, when I showed you the maps of future warming, and I said we have committed warming by 2025, that the current concentrations in the atmosphere are going to lead to, there is a lag in the system of as much as a century or so, actually. So it takes that long for everything, that all the gases that are out there, to work their way through the natural processes. And so if we end up at this point, in fact, we will then see temperatures continue to rise into the future for a period of another 100 years or so beyond that, which is why there is the urgency to turn this around as quickly as possible.
You show the slide of sea level rise in the S3 scenarios. Maybe I missed it, but how big an effect on sea level rise would there be if we pursued, say, the 450 trajectory? How much of an improvement can we expect?
Can we expect to see?
Yeah.
If we pursue a 450 trajectory, we could expect to come in at the lower end, towards the lower end of that range. Okay. So the lower end of the range was about 75 centimetres by 2100. Mm-hmm. So from Rahmstorff's work, he's suggesting that we'd be looking between 75 centimetres and maybe 80 or 90 or so. So we could still get up to about a metre of sea level rise, yeah, because of the inertia and the time lags in the system. So if we turn this around within the next decade or so and end up at 450, the lag, and that's emissions, concentrations in the atmosphere will then still continue to grow for a while. Temperatures will continue to grow for a longer period of time, and the ice loss will continue even beyond that. Okay, so there's a sort of progressive lag that comes into the system. So if we can stabilize at 450, then we'd be looking at something towards the lower end of that. But we still then have to deal with something between 75 centimeters and a meter of sea level rise, which is a lot.
Yeah.
Given that we're already seeing in Australia, and I used examples from the South Pacific, but think about the Australian coastline and the fact that there are already, you know, legal cases that have been in the news, mm-hmm, about coastal properties that are being eroded just from the current amounts of sea level rise that we've had, which are tiny compared to what's facing us. So it's, you know, still a fairly daunting prospect. Might be looking to relocate the Opera House.
Yes. One last question for Miles.
You spoke of tipping points.
Yes.
And in particular, I'm interested in the thaw of the permafrost.
Ah, oh, yes.
So how do scientists actually include in their estimates that ever-increasing amount of output from those types of phenomena?
The answer is we don't. In fact, current modelling does not include that. There have been studies, individual studies done, that have looked at what the possible effect could be, and the outcomes are alarming because methane is a particularly powerful greenhouse gas. It tends to be shorter lived in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide, but it's very effective at absorbing long-wave radiation. The question, it relates to the fact that in the high latitudes of the northern hemisphere, there are large amounts of frozen peat, basically, which contain fairly substantial amounts of methane and carbon. In fact, there's a lot of carbon dioxide trapped in those as well. And that has been frozen solid over a very long period of time since the end of the last ice age. Now the permafrost is thawing, and that is releasing methane in particular to the atmosphere. And the additional amounts of methane can have, if all of it's released, and particularly in a sudden burst such as, you know, is reflected there, but a possible methane outburst from a sudden thawing, that would have a very large impact on global warming. So it's a potentially a very serious issue. But as I say, in the standard modelling that's done, in the IPCC type modelling that is done, that is not factored in. In fact, the rates of greenhouse gas emission change in the IPCC scenarios depend on things like population growth and economic trajectory and fossil fuel intensity of energy production and so on. And that is then used to estimate what the outputs of the various greenhouse gases would be likely to be. They don't actually take this into account at all. So there's a lot of scope for things to be worse, in fact, the outcomes to be worse than the IPCC scenarios are suggesting. There's an amazing photograph that I've seen showing a scientist in Russia, I think it is, and he's standing next to a post that's stuck into the ground. And on the post, you can see the discoloration of the wood by the fact that it was embedded in the permafrost. And he's standing on the ground surface, and you can see where the ground surface was. And the former level of the ground surface is level with his shoulder. And he's standing on the current ground surface. And that is just that the land surface has sunk as the ice has melted. And it's going down. And of course, there's lots of implications for infrastructure and so on, because, you know, pipelines and roads and bridges and housing and industrial developments and so on are all built up there directly into the permafrost. It's permanent solid. You don't need to put in foundations. So you just build on the permafrost. But it's not so solid anymore. So there are a lot of issues facing countries like, or areas like Alaska and Russia and Canada and so on.
Amazing. All right, well, on that note, thank you again, and in fact, this is such an important issue, we may ask you back again, because it's been a fabulous presentation. So thank you very much. Thank you very much.